welcome to Evil in the Stacks. This is our second to last episode, and we're going to be talking about the satanic panic and kind of religion in horror comics and how that revolves around moral panics and that kind of thing. I do want to apologize for the delay on this episode. I've been sick and had absolutely no voice to do the intro and conclusion, which is also why my audio quality isn't perfect right now. So please forgive that. The interview was recorded previously, so it sounds much better. And buckle up for a really interesting conversation. Okay, thank you. All right, so I am here with Lucinda Holdsworth, and I'm going to have her introduce herself in a moment. But I wanted to do this interview with her because I am absolutely fascinated by the work that she does on comic books and kind of transmediality. And that's picking up from our last episode. That's kind of the topic for today. And also thinking about things like gender and moral panics. And I'm really excited for this one. So if you would like, Lucinda, go ahead and give like a brief intro. Anything you want people to check out, and we'll also loop back to that at the end.
Yeah. So yeah, as you say, my name is Lucinda Holdsworth. I'm a final year PhD student at the University of Glasgow in Scotland. So nearly done, nearly there. So my interest in this topic is my research is on the use and abuse of Lucifer in contemporary literary culture. So what that means is I'm primarily interested in the way that the figure of the devil has kind of been weaponized against disenfranchised and vulnerable communities throughout history. So you've got the obvious things like witch hunts and demonization of indigenous peoples and colonization. But most recently, during the Satanic Panic, which is my area of interest, as you kind of know, that's something that I'm really interested in. So my research is focused on the ways contemporary writers interact with that history and push back against it in their own use of the devil. The way that comics and transmediality and gender comes into that is that I kind of use Neil Gaiman's The Sandman as my foundational text. And I'm sure many of your listeners will have read it already, but if you haven't, please, listeners, read it. It's really good. But because he kind of resists the satanic panic rhetoric in a way that a lot of text at that time doesn't. And in terms of transmediality, a lot of the texts that end up pushing back against those harmful satanic panic narratives are either direct spin-offs, so things like Mike Carey's Lucifer and Holly Black's Lucifer, or they are these transmedia expansions, like the Netflix Lucifer series, or just really influenced by it, like Kieran Gillen and Jamie McKelvey's The Wicked and the Divine series. And that last one is where my interest in gender and transmediality comes in. Because their Lucifer is very obviously an homage to David Bowie, as it is in The Sandman, but in one it's a woman and one it's not. And that does resonate differently depending on gender, that Bowie devil combo, which I'm sure we'll talk about more later on. So part of my research is working out why that is, what's being conveyed here, why it's being received so differently across media and across gender.
All right. So let's just jump in with our first question. So before we really get into the more kind of theoretical questions that I have for you, would you mind giving a kind of rundown of how you see the trajectory of transmediality in horror comics? So where does it sort of begin? A rough estimate is fine, or just kind of your perception on the basis of your own interaction with the medium? And I do want to say, like, you don't have to have an exhaustive timeline or an exact date. That's totally fine. But because we went over it a little bit last time, I want to get your sense of, like, what is transmediality? When does it come about and how does it interact with horror in comics specifically?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question and a really difficult one to answer at the same time, because I think I think that there's definitely kind of a start point for transmediality becoming mainstream. But in terms of where it actually starts interacting with the horror comics genre and as a medium, I think it's kind of always been there. I think when you're trying to work out when horror comics start going transmedia, you have to work out, well, when did horror comics begin? Because it's that far back, really. And I think a lot of that has to do with where horror comics finds its roots both on the horror side and in the comic side, because I think these both have a lot that they've inherited from religious art and religious storytelling, which itself is often spoken of as the roots of transmedia storytelling. You know, you've got the stories in the Bible being transposed onto stained glass windows and into illuminated manuscripts and all these kinds of things. And those things, those same things like illuminated manuscripts and stained glass windows with a little caption is often cited as the birth of comics as well. So I don't think these are necessarily separable. And on the horror side as well, horror has always been interested in the otherworldly and in religious spheres. So I think that necessarily means it's also had a very interesting relationship with religious figures and has been transposing them had a kind of transmedia relationship to them as long as it's existed. So I realize this isn't really an answer to your question in terms of the history, but I don't think there is necessarily a start date. I think it's always been a part of it, because I think that's kind of what humans like to do with storytelling. I think it's not so much a new invention as an inherent desire of humans as storytelling creatures. I think about myself, like as a kid on the playground, like we'd make up stories, we'd put on plays, and then we'd come back in and we'd draw little pictures of our characters and comics and stuff. And that's transmedia storytelling. And no one told us how to do it or what it was. It was just instinct. I think it's something that's always been there. It's just becoming more visible now because we have so many more different kinds of media that we can do this with.
That's fascinating. I actually hadn't thought about it in that kind of context, but it makes a lot of sense, right? Especially thinking about like illuminated manuscripts, which I will say we do have. I'm just going to throw that out there for listeners who are interested in that end of things. We have some, and it would be really fascinating as a research area to come in and put the comics collection in conversation with the like rare books and the illuminated manuscripts now that you mention it. So thank you for that.
No, absolutely. I couldn't give you any specifics on this, but I remember speaking to someone here at the University of Glasgow a couple of years ago who I think was doing their thesis on finding the roots of comics in medieval Jewish illuminated manuscripts. So I think there's some interesting work going on with that at the moment. Although again, I couldn't give you much depth on that, I'm afraid.
That's okay. Okay. So then kind of moving a little bit more recently, we see transmedia storytelling proliferate across genres, obviously, but do you think there's something unique to how it happens in horror, right? So I'm thinking here about the difference between like the Marvel Cinematic Universe versus the kind of like inspiration transmedia storytelling that we get with something like Tales from the Crypt and a film like Creepshow, because those are some of the ones we have materials on. So do you have any thoughts on like why horror specifically, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think inspirational is a really great way to put it. Creepshow as well. It's certainly more interested in evoking like the feeling from Tales of the Crypt than it is continuing any specific story from it, which is definitely not the kind of traditional understanding of transmedia. But again, I think that comes back to the religious tradition in the way that it deals with transmediality. I think it's far more common in that kind of transmedial expansion to take a specific character, whether that's, you know, God or the devil or whoever you want to go with, and kind of run with them rather and just see what they'll do in this other context, this other medium, rather than telling one unified story, because the Bible is the unified story. You're not really supposed to alter that or, you know, in any way. And I think there's a lot of that same approach in the way that horror does transmedia storytelling, like importing Dracula into new situations and media. You know, that's far more about exploring the character in that space rather than telling a unified story of his life. But you can't make Bram Stoker's novel and the Castlevania games exist in the same universe. They just won't do it. But that's not what they're trying to do. It's more like explorative, I think. I think it's definitely something to do with the religious inheritance. Because when I think about the way that other comic genres approach transmediality, I could never get away with just like telling and selling a story about Spider-Man or Batman. Like, I'd have so many lawyers coming at me.
Yes.
But Thor, maybe I could, because there's a bit of the kind of religious element there. So I think there's definitely something of that in what makes horror comics unique in its approach.
Right. And it's interesting that you would mention Dracula. Our episode for next month is with Gwendolyn Keist, whose new novel, Reluctant Immortals, is a take on Bertha Rochester and Lucy Westenra from Dracula.
Okay. That'd be a great episode. I have to listen. Yeah.
Yeah. That's the end of next month. So the end of April. So we're kind of talking broadly about transmedia storytelling. And if we follow someone like Henry Jenkins, who brought the term kind of to popularity, maybe not like coined it, but really made it something that people outside of that specific field paid attention to. He has a fairly strict definition. It excludes things like adaptation. So even something like an illuminated manuscript, a stained glass window, like that kind of thing is tricky if you're going to exclude adaptation. And he kind of defines it as the continuation of the same story, characters, or universe, or some other kind of narrative element. So it still makes sense in terms of thinking about like the Crypt Keeper getting taken up in other iterations, right? But I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about whether this kind of exclusionary definition makes any sense anymore in 2023, especially thinking about fan-created content, which is a lot of what we see in transmedial horror, right? It's George Romero was a fan of Tales from the Crypt, and therefore Creepshow happened, right? So I'm wondering if you have any thoughts there, if you think we need a better term or just to update the definition. Like, where do you land on this?
Oh, I have too many thoughts, to be honest. This is something that I spent a very long time wrestling with at the start of my thesis, because you're right, it's a very exclusionary definition. I think transmedia storytelling, as Jenkins understands it or as he defines it, is very, very rare. I think he used the example of maybe the Matrix in conversions culture.
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, so things like that, where it is very much a concerted effort with the same creators behind all of it, overseeing it in a very detail-oriented way. It's very, very rare. And I do think we need a word to describe just this unique kind of storytelling, because it is special when it goes right. But I don't think that is what transmedia storytelling is currently used to describe a lot of the time. So I don't think it necessarily includes everything that we want to talk about in this field. You know, most things you think about as transmedia, like the MCU, or like the new approach to Star Wars. I can't remember the name for their
new Mandalorian, or are you thinking of a different one?
I mean, their new kind of approach where it's part of this new story world. Because I think they got rid of a lot of the old canon and are now going for a more kind of transmedia approach, as Jenkins would understand it. But it's still not quite what Jenkins is talking about, because there are still retcons and reboots, and there's so much content that clashes or has inconsistencies that it requires really complex negotiation between these tiers of canonicity. I think it's Mark Wolf speaks about tiers of canonicity, just for any listeners who aren't familiar. It's this idea that if you imagine like a pyramid of hierarchies, where the top tier will be things that are created by the original author of a series or director or whatever it might be, and then right at the bottom it will be like fan created content. And the idea is things can only be seen as part of this unified story world if it doesn't conflict with anything higher up in the tiers of canonicity. And I think that that's a model that a lot of large transmedia franchises have used for a long time, but it doesn't really reflect the way that people actually interact with and experience these stories. And when I say that, I'm thinking particularly about the way that the Harry Potter fandom interacts with a lot of J.K. Rowling's new work. People do not like The Cursed Child, and you know, I'm with them on that. people, it's considered non-canonical, despite the fact that it should be in the top tier of that hierarchy. And, you know, a lot of people do see things like a Harry Potter musical as canon, which is a fan-made creation. So when it comes to actual experiences of these transmedia franchises, it's not as simple as this hierarchy that we pretend it is. So I don't know if there is a term to describe all of these phenomena that aren't quite adaptation, but aren't quite transmedia and kind of live in the boundaries. Maybe cross-media or franchise storytelling or something like that. But I do think we need a different approach to the way that we talk about it, certainly. And the approach that I take to it, particularly horror storytelling, isn't actually part of transmedia theory. I tend to approach it from more of a trauma studies perspective.
Okay, so to get to something a little closer to your own research before I get some more specific questions, would you mind explaining kind of the background of the satanic panic for our audience, and perhaps also moral panics kind of broadly? I know I've mentioned them in past episodes, but kind of a more concrete explanation from an expert might be really helpful here.
Yeah, so moral panics, I've got like a kind of official definition from a legal dictionary. It's defined as a mass movement based on the false or exaggerated perception that some cultural behavior or group of people is dangerously deviant and poses a threat to society's values and interests. So what that essentially means is that it's a mass hysteria, mass panic, basically about usually something that is new or perceived to be new. It's often a very right-wing phenomenon, and it's often used as an excuse to demonize people without institutional power or new phenomena, new ways of being. And it's often justified through this idea that you're protecting women or children from something dangerous from the outside. So some examples are like the violence in video games, moral panic, or the devil's music panic when blues started kind of being a thing, or even the novel reading panic when women started reading books. Mm-hmm. Gotta keep them safe from those dangerous books. So the satanic panic, which is what I'm really interested in, was a moral panic in the early 1980s to late 1990s, but it's resurged in recent years through QAnon's conspiracy theories. And the fear that this really centers around is this idea that there are satanic cults that have infiltrated all levels of society, but particularly schools and daycare facilities or anywhere where people have access to children. And there was this idea that children were being secretly subjected to these rituals and sort of sexual ritual harm, cannibalism, infanticide, all these things. And it was supposed to have been happening in the hundreds and thousands, and everyone was just repressing the memories of it, which is obviously just, you know, is not happening. And the official start date is usually given as 1980 with the publication of this book called Michelle Remembers. You're nodding. Yeah.
Yes, I am familiar with Michelle Remembers.
It's a wild ride. Yeah.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah, so the idea of that book is it's this autobiography where a woman named Michelle Smith claimed to have been part of a satanic cult that abused her for years as a child. She'd repressed the memories, and then they only came out when her therapist, Lawrence Pazda, now her husband, so, you know, yeah, insight into the medical malpractice that is behind a lot of the satanic panic, you know, uncovered all these memories and made us suddenly remember. But a lot of the satanic panic is following in this kind of medical malpractice, particularly around recovered memory therapy, which just ended up being really harmful and implanting a bunch of false memories around people's fears, essentially. Mm-hmm. So that's what the satanic panic was, really.
So one of the titles in our collection that I kind of expect most closely aligns with your research is Hellblazer, which we have kind of a handful of issues of, but could you talk a bit about this title if you're familiar with it? If not, no worries. But also like thinking about it in relation to your own work and kind of cross-media adaptation.
Yeah. I mean, I think Hellblazer is a really interesting one for how it interacts with the satanic panic. because it, I mean, my research is particularly, as I said, on the Sandman, but Hellblazer does a lot of things very similar to Sandman in that that kind of horror comic in this era acted as a site of resistance to a lot of the claims that were being made in the Satanic Panic, and kind of holding a mirror up to the people who were making those accusations, particularly in Jamie Delano's original run, which is a lot more political than the later ones, is really drawing on Satanic Panic fears. There's loads of satanic cults everywhere, echoing that feeling that they are in every level of society, and all of the cults are constantly going after kids to subject them to some kind of ritual or to be a child bride or, you know, some kind of exploitation. Constantine's backstory is very Satanic Panic. The girl Astra that he fails to save, which is kind of his inciting incident, is sexually abused by a cult and used in their rituals. And he gets that information from her by literally performing recovered memory therapy. It's like exactly like Michelle Remembers, essentially. So it's really setting up the Satanic Panic fear. And then it really deconstructs all of it. So Constantine himself becomes the UK's most wanted because all the tabloids are reporting on him being a Satanist slayer, in exactly the same ways as those same tabloids were reporting on it at the time. But we've been with him the whole time. We know he's not done these things. We know how false it is. And we know it's just a convenient narrative. And all of these cults are kind of linked to they're equal and opposite in these fundamentalist Christian cults. So it's really kind of holding up the mirror to the kinds of groups that were making these satanic accusations, which were mostly right-wing Christians, and saying, this is you, you're describing, this isn't me, this is a false narrative. And as far as cross-media adaptation and gender, I think that there's a lot of kind of interesting nuances with gender-bending characters in these texts in a very similar way to the way that Sandman has kind of been doing it. You know, you've got Jana Coleman as Constantine in the Sandman TV series and Tilda Swinton as Gabriel in the Keanu Reeves film. I must admit, I'm not as familiar with the other Constantine TV series. And I love that they're playing around with gender and the adaptations and I love the representation, but I do think that there needs to be perhaps a bit more nuance in the way that these are approached. Because it's interesting that both Sandman and Hellblazer have chosen particularly angels to gender bend, because it makes sense because, you know, they're supposed to be agender anyway. But the number one story that we tell about angels is them falling and losing their power. And there's such a long history of women being considered fallen in situations where men wouldn't. And those traditions aren't necessarily interacted with, either positively or negatively, which is not to say that I want, you know, all female versions of characters to be about being a woman, because that also sucks. But I think that the way that transmedia franchises engage with gender across texts has room for a lot more nuance and insightful meaning that isn't necessarily always being brought out yet. And I think Hellblazer is an example of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So the last question, and I love that you mentioned Jamie Delano. I had another question that referenced that run in particular, which I can skip now. So the kind of last thing I wanted to talk about is Delano as a figure, like, worked on a number of other popular titles, including some Batman, Swamp Thing, and Doctor Who issues, in addition to kind of clear transmedia tie-in content, like the promo comic for Twisted Metal 2, which I find endlessly fascinating. It's the second installment, or it's the promotional material for the second installment in the Twisted Metal video games franchise, that kind of gained popularity in the midst of another moral panic around violent video games, right? So do you see any kind of useful connections between creators who cross fluidly between horror and kind of more general audience transmedia storytelling, and then also like the phenomenon of moral panics that seems to crop up around horror specifically and then gets kind of dragged across genre or medium lines, right? Do you see that happening? Do you have any thoughts there?
Yeah, I think that's such an interesting question. I think, I mean, I don't think particular transmedia horror creators necessarily kind of court moral panics, although poor Jamie Delano has been subject to many. But I do think that the form itself kind of does to a certain extent. I think transmedia storytelling is always going to be at risk of moral panics because the nature of it means it's playing with new technology a lot of the time and new media. And new things are so often what moral panics are about. It's a fear mm-hmm. of the unknown. And at the same time, it's usually younger generations that are going to be picking up these new technologies. So there's more of that fear that something might corrupt the children and we have to protect them from whatever this is. And I think particularly when it comes to horror, I mean, horror just in general deals with things that are more controversial, right? It's the things we don't want to acknowledge when the lights are on. It's often obliquely kind of dressed up as a supernatural monster, but it's still a lot more direct than a lot of other media is at addressing things. And at the same time, it kind of repeats all our worst, most bigoted fears. I'm just thinking of the number of monsters that are rooted in anti-Semitism, let alone all the other isms that the horror can perpetuate when it's not handled well. So horror is always really ideologically charged, right? Mm-hmm. Whether you're seeing your worst fear made monstrous or being made fun of, it's going to make you feel some kind of way. Right. Add to that the fact that new media is already at risk of broad panics. Add to that the fact that it's more likely to be taken up by younger generations. I think the parents are just always going to freak out about horror transmedia. I think that's mm-hmm. kind of unavoidable to a certain extent. Sometimes that's good if there's content in there that is actually kind of damaging, but I think most of the time that happens for the wrong reasons.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, I'll also note, like you said about the way that gender gets kind of taken up as a way to alter the story. I mean, I am most familiar with the Tilda Swinton Gabriel in Constantine, which is the Keanu Reeves version of I guess version is the best word of Hellblazer. Because you make a really good point about women as like fallen and angels as fallen. And so even though that character isn't monstrous necessarily, like it's still reifying a certain kind of gendered stereotype or gendered dynamic that is really deeply conservative, right? Mm. So I think there's something to be said for not just the monsters being problematic, but the whole kind of structure can fall back into a kind of social conservatism if we're not careful.
I think there's a particular risk of that with a lot of transmedia spaces because comics and like horror comics are so often put right at the bottom of that tier of canonicity, very unfairly a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. That means that a lot of the space where people are playing around with new ideas, as comics allows you to do, and kind of being more experimental, is kind of left in those marginal spaces because they're not allowed to kind of travel up the pyramid to these higher ones because they get a bad reaction from you know, the loud conservative voices in a lot of fan spaces. And then that again kind of solidifies this more kind of conservative approach to the whole franchise because the experimental things aren't allowed to progress any further than the marginalized aspect.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Is there anything, do you have anything out in publication, website, anything like that that you want to plug before I wrap up?
I should have thought of this before I came.
No worries. I can also put links in the show notes.
Sure. Yeah. I have a chapter coming out in a book on horror comics and religion, edited by Brandon Graffius and John Moorhead in a couple of months, I think.
Okay.
But other than that, I think just watch this space. Yeah.
Okay. Fantastic. Thank you so much, Lucinda, for being on. This was a wonderful, fascinating interview. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
All right. Thank you so much for listening to Evil in the Stacks this month.
Because of the delay, we will actually have a shorter turnaround with the next episode. And that one I'm really excited for. It is an interview with Gwendolyn Keist, whose archive we have at Pitt, talking about all kinds of things. Her book, Reluctant Immortals, that just came out recently, her writing process, kind of women and gender in horror fiction, and much, much more. So I hope you will join us at the end of the month for that episode. All right. Have a good day.